It is now my signature honor and pleasure and privilege to welcome once again to the Middle Chamber our good friend, author John Lamlash from MetaHistory.org. Good morning, John. How are you?
Morning, Frederick. Just fine. Hanging in there.
Okay, well, I had a whole bunch of stuff I wanted to get through before I brought you on, and I managed to pull it off. We got a few minutes here before the first break. I've been so looking forward to not only continuing our conversation, but also wrapping up the discussion that we had, that I've had several people contact me interested in our conclusions concerning the occult roots of the Russian Revolution.
Oh, it's a really fascinating subject, and it doesn't take that much of a deep research to look into it and to grasp the essentials. And when you do, I find it way that it's extremely revealing mirror to our times today, both in the positive and negative aspect of this this global uprising that we're now facing, especially the American front.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that it is also an important fact, because I think we're seeing, especially in the 21st century with all that's going on globally and ecologically, I think that there was a sense of that, or at least the sense of what would be considered, I think, pagan sentiment nowadays, or the true literal sense, the country dweller sentiment, the idea of the people being connected to the land. That seemed to be a very clear notion amongst the, well, what would you call them, the working class or the peasantry of Russia of that time.
Yeah, it's called land mysticism. There was, coming up to the Russian Revolution, a tremendous wave of telluric or land mysticism among the Russian people, who saw in their country, in their land in particular, they didn't see it in the entire planet as we might do today, but they saw in the landmass of Russia actually the body of a divine being, very much identified with the Sophia. They didn't have the Sophia myth as we have it today, but they had a dawning sense of the presence of the Earth Mother. And they identified with it, and it was actually the basis of their mystical and political views in many, many, many ways. I mean, this is the amazing revelation we get from looking at the Russian Revolution.
And it's a fine detail that I think is lost in the shuffle of the history as it's laid down in the textbooks.
Yeah, well, when the Bolsheviks came in, which was the control opposition of the Russian Revolution, funded by the bankers, they totally wiped out the Sophianic aspect, and they totally destroyed everyone who represented the intellectuals and mystics who represented the possibility that that would emerge as part of the revolutionary ideology, and they reduced it to money and resources and to the enslavement of the people.
And there are a few key philosophers that we can look at from this time and place, too, that exemplify that idealism.
Yes, I believe philosophers we have and poets. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So we are back in the Middle Chamber with John Lash from MetaHistory.org. Is there anything new, John?
Not really, because since about July of last year, I've been concentrating on this project that I call the Gaia Navigation Experiment. And I haven't been writing anything for MetaHistory for about 6 months, but I have been writing for this navigation experiment. And if you want to follow that, some of the members of the experiment, I call them my crew, I call myself the navigator, and they're my crew, generously volunteered to set up a new website for me dedicated to that, and that is telestai.org, telestai.org. So all of my recent writings of the last 6 months will be found there rather than on metahistory.org, which is kind of sleeping right now.
And there's also another radio archive set up too, right? Isn't it called, what is it called, Radio? Is it
Radio Telestai, yes.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
On the same site. It has all of the talks, many of the talks I did with various people, and the series of talks with Grok the Talk, Thomas Malone.
That's the place to go. Excellent interviews with Thomas, too. I got to say, mm-hmm. the last two with him, and then the most recent crew note number 14, I think it was, that you did.
Right.
was just excellent as well. So I highly recommend anybody who's interested in what John's talking about, go check out those. You can check them out at the Radio Telestai. And there is pretty much everything you've done is listed there at this point, isn't it, on the as far as radio interviews and podcasts, right?
Yeah, it's a massive amount that's accumulated just over the last 6 months. So you can listen to any of the talks, and you can read all the crew notes. It's completely open. It's not a closed site. There is a forum that you can join as well. Just want to invite everyone to look into it, and I want to say that you will find in there maybe something that you never, ever conceived before, which is how we can participate in the correction of Gaia Sophia. And secondly, there is no metaphysics in this process.
And, yeah, that's something I want to address at some point in our conversations as well, because I'd like to get a little bit more into detail about that comment that you give, mm-hmm. that position. One more thing I wanted to make a point about on the website. It is a vast website, the metahistory.org. I've had people contact me, John, and they're like, oh, where do I begin? And what I usually say to them, and I think you'll probably agree, is to take the tour of the website
first. Take the tour. Yeah.
And then you get
it. It's
good,
a spoken tour.
You
it's
are the one that speaks, right?
That's right. I take you and walk you through the website. It is absolutely massive. It's probably the equivalent of 20 books.
Yeah.
And, of course, anyone would be overwhelmed. So if you go to the site guide and click on it, you'll see that it gives you the option to click on to actually five sequential MP3 files in which I walk you through the site. And on that basis, you might well be able to decide which aspect of the site you would like to investigate first.
And when I first, you know, came upon your site back in, I think it was 2006, maybe, and at that point, it was even smaller than it is now. And what I basically did, because I don't think you had that virtual tour yet, or if you did,
no.
I didn't notice it.
No, I didn't. I didn't have it yet. Yeah.
I just downloaded everything of interest until I filled a 5-subject, 3-ring binder notebook and basically just studied all the material, read it cover to cover, and, you know, just took it on board that way. And then, of course, that was before you'd even written the book. So I waited for the book to come out and then, you know, put it on the Christmas list. So, but anyways.
You know, there is a section on MetaHistory.org called The Alternative Grail, and it's an entire book. It's probably a 350-page book if you printed it out.
I'm very proud of this.
You haven't read that. The Alternative History of the Grail. And it has now, I think, 9 chapters, and it's very unique. I'm really proud of it. It's some of my best writing, my best historical writing and investigation. And, of course, it touches the profound mystery of the Grail and provides a view, an experiential and view of what the Grail is. I'm not talking about what I think it might be. I'm not giving you my interpretation of what it is. I'm giving you my experience of the attainment of the Grail. And it's beautiful, but it's still, that book is undone, and it brings us to our current subject, Frederick, because if I were to complete the history of the alternative history of the Grail for the last few chapters, it would bring us up to Russia, and it would bring us up to the figure of Vladimir Soloviev and the Russian symbolist movement at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. And I haven't written those last chapters, so what I'm sort of doing with you is getting them out in the course of our conversations.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's steer it back around to the occult roots. I wonder if I might just read a little paragraph that maybe would bring us back to topic, and then we could take it off the shore from there.
Sure.
Just a little paragraph from page 3 of the article that we are using as our source material, which is the article from the Gnostic.com website called Occult Roots of the Russian Revolution.
That's right.
It's just a little paragraph that says, "The origin of Gnostic ideas in Russia is difficult to trace, but they appear to be the outgrowth of two powerful spiritual impulses in Russian religious history. The first is the Christian esoteric tradition preserved within the monastic communities of the Russian Orthodox Church, a mystical tradition going back by way of Greek Neoplatonism, Origen and Clement of Alexandria, to St. John, the beloved disciple. Russian Orthodox mystical theology has bent more than a little in the direction of the Gnostic heresy, notes historian Maria Carlson. The second impulse originated with the Essenes, the Manichaean missionaries who reached Russia in the early centuries of the Christian era, an impulse later given new vitality by the Bogomils, whose Gnostic teachings had gained a foothold in Russia by the 13th century.
Right. Well, you know, the book by Maria Carlson, No Religion Higher Than Truth, is absolutely tremendous for anyone who wants to explore this subject. Anyway, I just want to say that all of that is an example of how scholars don't get to it. You know, it's how they try, and they're well-intended, but they don't get to it. They can't get to it because they're not inside the process, and they don't really understand the origins of the deep Gnostic underground movement because they are not Gnostics. So no matter how they may try and no matter what little points and clues of truth may be indicated in the paragraph you just read, it falls very, very far of the mark. The reality is that the diaspora of the mystery schools of ancient, of the Mediterranean, the mystery schools of which I talk about so much, who had possession of knowledge of the Grail and taught the Grail and brought the Grail to people, and taught through the experience of the Grail, which is the encounter with the organic light. That's actually what it is. Those people were decimated by the rise of Christianity, and they went into hiding. And you can trace their movement, their refugee. You can trace the refugee movement of the mysteries up until around 1250 A.D., and then, of course, the Catholic Church, who had been hunting them down and stalking and killing them already for 800 years, went into even higher gear to hunt down the ones that were left. This is how dangerous these people are. These a Gnostic is a really dangerous animal when it comes to the patriarchal dominator fanatics on this planet. When it comes to the psychopaths, we are their worst fucking nightmare. And we're still here. But it's very difficult to trace the survival of this Gnostic movement and the survival of those who carried the actual experience of encountering the organic light forward from the 13th century, because the thread gets really, really thin and goes way, way underground. So none of these historical analysis really track that. That's what I would have done in the last three chapters of this book on the alternative history of the Grail. But I can tell you that when you track that thread underground, you find that the Sophianic and Gnostic traditions emerged in Russia at the end of the 19th century because they were brought there by people of the diaspora of the mysteries. They were actually brought there through a group of people, through particular individuals, most notably someone called Prince Trubetskoy. And so that's how I would trace it.
Well, I wonder if I might stop and ask one question. Would you say that the descent of the refugee mystery tradition to underground in the 13th century coincides with the rise of the warrior monk orders in society, in the European and Asian societies, with the samurai and the crusaders and the Moors?
That's a very interesting parallel. I'd have to investigate that more. I don't know if I can give an adequate answer. Certainly the two things coincided, Frederick.
Chronologically.
What the exact relation,
right.
Chronologically. And what the relationship between them would be, I don't know. I have pointed out, however, that the Order of Chivalry, the Arthurian knights and so forth, in the Westlands of Scotland and England and Wales, and in northern France, so forth, was directly related to the need to protect the survivors of the mysteries. That's why the Arthurian Knight Round Table was founded by Merlin, who was a mystery school initiate in the 5th century, in the early 400s. And this is all explained at length in the chapters of my alternative history of the Grail, which is on metahistory.org.
Yeah, as I understand it, there were many Merlins. I mean, Merlin was actually
right.
a title, wasn't it?
It was a title, right. But there was a specific one, or perhaps a specific personality associated with one, who actually founded the Round Table, the Arthurian Knights, for the purpose of protecting the refugees from the mystery schools.
And that was in the 9th or 5th?
That was in the 5th century, in the early 400s.
So it would be after the...
Death of Hypatia.
Okay, the death of Hypatia,
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And then the next wave would, the 13th century would be the Cathar repression, right?
And right, that's
another,
right.
Another need for the chivalric orders to protect them. Because
right, but there weren't any chivalric orders to protect the Cathars, as we well know.
Although
some of the Cathars were themselves warriors, and they built fortresses, the Cathar castles, which still remain, which are magnificent haunted places to visit. So it's very interesting parallelism that you bring up there, but I don't know exactly what to make of it.
It'd be interesting to look into that some more. But all right, so excuse me, we were considering the individuals in the Russian society that would
right.
that were instrumental in bringing about this idealism.
That's right. How Russian society in the 19th century and in the early 20th century was in some ways seeded or inseminated with the Gnostic mystery school wisdom that survived, and it just barely survived, just a trickle of it survived. But it is such a powerful elixir. It's like the 52 fragmentary documents of Nag Hammadi. It's just a flake, but it's so powerful. This Gnosticism is so powerful that it was able, in 19th century Russia, to actually inspire and infuse an entire socio-mystical movement, which was spearheaded or figureheaded by Vladimir Soloviev.
And was he an aesthetic, or was he a poet? What was his status?
He was a mystic, an intellectual, a Russian intellectual, a mystic, and a teacher, and a writer. But he's not a poet. But he had poets around him, notably Andre Bieli, B-I-E-L-Y, one of the great poets and novelists of the 20th century, and Alexander Bloch. Bieli and Bloch were his two main protégés, and a lot of what he taught was expressed in their poetry and writings. So the symbolist movement is what you want to look into.
Russian symbolism. Okay, well, we'll be right back with John Lash as we continue this fascinating discussion. Stay with us. Radio Free Humanity, Freighter X, and John Lamb Lash. And we are discussing the occult roots of the Russian Revolution. And when we went to break, we were just bringing up the topic of Russian symbolism, how employed by those in the 19th century and early 20th century to basically convey a Gnostic idealism to the general public of Russia or to the society at large. So, John, if you'd like to pick that back up on the Russian symbolism, and let's take a look at that together.
Sure, I'd love to. One of the aspects of the practice, Telestic practice, which is the noetic science and the educational method of Gnosis, is to be extremely careful with syntax, to be very respectful and careful with the language one uses, and to frame things carefully. You know, an argument can go wrong, or an argument can be useless and futile if it's not framed correctly in the first place. We all know, I think, today, the importance of framing things. So I just want to frame up for those who are following these talks, frame up very quickly, a very quick chronology. You know, you don't have to go very far back into the past for this. And you can read any standard book on the Russian Revolution of 100 or 150 pages, which will give you all you need to know. But I'd like to frame up a little chronology as the background, and then, as I do so, to show what are the parallels to what's happening in America today. There are really only four key dates that you need to know to understand what happened in the Russian Revolution. And the first one is actually in 1825. And that is, of course, well before the revolution occurred, because the revolution occurred in 1917, right?
1917, correct.
Yeah, so why do we go back to 1825 for the first chronological moment and the first point of reflection to the current global uprising? Because in 1825, there was a failed revolt in Russia. It's called the Decembrist Revolt. D-E-C-E-M-B-R-I-S-T. And if you Google Decembrist Revolt, you'll be able to read about it in a few minutes. Essentially, it was a stand down of the Tsar's army and the leading officers in the military cadres of the Tsarist army, which was massive, the Tsar being the Emperor of Russia. A stand down of the Tsarist military leaders, who were soldiers, most of whom were aristocrats, who were actually going to revolt against the Tsarist regime in behalf of the people. Can you imagine anything as wild as that?
It's as it should be. I mean, armies should support the populace, right?
Now, what are we looking at today?
Exactly.
You know, there's one possibility that could happen in the American military.
I was thinking they could stand down. I was thinking the Egyptian Revolution most recently.
Yeah, that's right. You see, when this happens, the machinations and orchestrations of the powers that be are immediately railroaded and driven off the tracks, because they do not, the masterminds of globalist domination and the patriarchal pathologues, the patriarchal predators, don't do anything themselves, do they? They rely on might and on military force. So if there's a stand down and a mutiny and revolt in the military today, were there to be one, there would be no danger of us heading into World War III, which we're already in, by the way. So this is something that you want to look at, that it happened almost 90 years, 80 years before the Russian Revolution, but it was squashed and it failed.
Huh.
So beware of that historical lesson, my friends.
Yeah.
Okay? Secondly, we jump ahead to the second day, 1905. In Russia, that's when strikes and great civil uprising began, and the revolt against the absolutely insane and absurdly Baroque and Byzantine control system of Tsarist Russia. Just like in America, we have an insane and absurdly Baroque and Byzantine federal control system with the TSA and all the incredible 40,000 laws that they passed last year and the NDAA and all that. It's a very clear parallel. And in 1905, people began to revolt against this. They began to dissent. They began to complain. So we see this. This is an exact parallel of what's happening now. American people particularly are being pushed to the wall by this agenda. And we have the NWO movement. We have other forms of state secession. We have the Oath Keepers, which is a fantastic movement, kind of going back to the Decembrist idea, you know, that the military and the police would stand down and would take the side of the people. So this is another clear parallel. The uncivil unrest began in 1905, but it didn't really break out until 12 years later. Things are going to happen a lot faster in the U.S., okay?
And it was because the Russian society had been crippled by its involvement in World War I at that point, correct?
And also because the suppression and the repression of the Russian spirit and the Russian people was so immense under the Tsar that it took them like 12 years before their rage, they could really articulate their rage. But dig this. This is a really another key lesson of reflection between then and now. You know, February 1917 is called the February Revolution, and October 1917 is called the October Revolution. So there are two moments of the Russian Revolution that everyone can learn about. This is extremely enlightening. The February Revolution was when they said, okay, we can't take the absolute totalitarian tyranny of the Tsar anymore and his bizarre system of rulership, which included the Okhrana. I don't know if you know that was the Tsarist secret service, and it was the seed of the KGB and of every subsequent secret Homeland Security, Gestapo, military organization directed against the people. The great granddaddy of all that was the Okhrana of the Tsarist Secret Service of Russia. And so people were facing this incredible surveillance. They were facing many of the things that are in exact parallel to what the American population is facing today. If you read into this, I think you'll be stunned by how close the parallel was. So the first thing that happened in the revolution was in February, some of the revolutionaries decided to say, said, asserted their will against the czarist regime and said, we need our own representative form of government. So they formed what they called the Duma, which is a kind of parliament. And they said, okay. And the czar conceded to a certain extent because he realized that this is a really bad situation. And if he didn't give these people something of what they wanted, all hell was going to break loose. So the Duma was a good idea because it was the seed of an opportunity for the Russian people to start to have their own political voice and perhaps even some form of representative democracy. That was February 1917. Now get this, folks. By October 1917, 6 months later, the entire opposition revolutionary movement had been co-opted. That's how long it took.
That was the Bolsheviks moving in.
The Bolsheviks. Bolshevik is just a word in Russian. It's a very common word. It just means majority. And Menshevik means minority. So what happened is there were two parties in the Duma. The Duma was formed, and there were the Mensheviks, or the minority party, and there were the Bolsheviks, or the majority party. But the trick is that the Bolsheviks, who took over and commandeered the revolution in October of 1917, like Lenin and so forth, and Trotsky, were paid, suborned members of a controlled opposition run by the international bankers who funded the Russian Revolution and all the subsequent wars of the 20th century.
Hence the importation of Trotsky and Lenin into Russia, one from Mexico, the other from
Switzerland.
Via England. And they were put on closed trains, but they couldn't speak to anyone, and they had to go through all the nations to their destination without getting off the train or talking to anyone. Complete isolation.
Very interesting. That's right. A very interesting point that I bring up in Not in His Image is that Edmund Wilson, who was a writer who wrote one of the best and first books on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which, of course, in which he revealed that they were not Christian, they were not benevolent documents, but they were actually documents of a terrorist organization that provided the roots for Christianity. Very shocking, scandalous book.
Wow, yeah.
By Edmund Wilson, also wrote Toward the Finland Station. And Toward the Finland Station, if anyone wants to get their nose deep into the fumes, the smoky satanic fumes of the Russian Revolution, read Toward the Finland Station by Edmund Wilson. First of all, it's a magnificent piece of writing. He was a superb writer. But it describes that journey of Lenin from Switzerland toward the Finland Station, which is where he got off at Finland and went into Russia. And that was the penetration of the controlled opposition, which in a matter of months completely took over the Russian Revolution. Now, if you go back and read that lesson and reflect upon what could happen in America if a parallel event took place, and look now at where that controlled opposition is being set up to the revolution of the genuine revolution of the American people against federal tyranny and the phony war on terror.
Well, you have two camps as far as I can tell. We'll have to get back to that when we come back from the break. This is an awesome conversation. Stay tuned for more from John Lash, MetaHistory.org, with me, Freighter X, here in Radio Free Humanity. Now, remember, check out all the links on the show website, especially tonight's guest's website link, which is on our website, and that's MetaHistory.org. Take the virtual tour of the site. Also check out Teleste.com. Is that what it was, John?
Right, Teleste.com.
Teleste.com as well, and Radio Teleste. Those are two adjoining sites. There's so much information on all this. Take your time. Let it flow. You know, just take it on board as it comes, and you won't be disappointed, really. It's next-level stuff. And when I first came upon this material, I started telling people consistently that this was, especially the book Not in His Image, was one of the most important books in our time to read. And that's my personal belief. So really, really, if what you're hearing John say and what you've heard him say in the past stirs something within you, check out his website, get his book, and check it out because you won't be disappointed. Now, also, keep checking in on the Type1Roadshow.com site. You know, I know it's still under construction. There's not a lot going on right now, but it is moving forward. We have new developments every day in the organizational front. On that front, we have Brandon and Brett. They're like our Type 1 apostles, truly sent ones from the east, heading further west. They're on their way across the country, headed for Hawaii. They're spreading the message of our vision, of our hope, as we look towards a new day dawning for us all. At least that's what we hope. And the idea of the Type 1 Roadshow and Traveling Mystery School is an idea for us to all build a network and try to create a resonant frequency that we can all, you know, ascend together. And so that's the idea, you know, is coming together, sharing our experiences, our insights, our gifts, our talents. We believe that this time in our lives as human species, we need to realize what is valuable. And you know what the most valuable currency, as far as I'm concerned, of the future is talents and traits and abilities, being able to make things and grow things and fix things. This is wealth. This is true value. And if you want to be of valuable service to your species, learn how to make, grow, and fix stuff. And that's what we need in the future. So on that note, if anybody wants to call in with this conversation now, please call in 218-339-8525 as we continue with this conversation. And we left it off where we were just laying the ground. Well, we'd set up the chronology, and then we talked about the minority versus the majority within the Duma. That was the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks.
Right.
And we, you had asked the question, looking at the modern day arena or the atmosphere that we're involved in here, the environment politically, where do we see
the coming revolution in America? The coming revolution in America, which is underway. Is it already have a controlled opposition factor operating in it? We see that the controlled opposition was inserted into the revolution almost immediately when it got rolling. It's pitiful to really see how quickly it was hijacked. And so the lesson in history is what? Well, if we're looking at another revolution now in America, which is in many ways the counterpart of Russia, spiritually and otherwise, the mirror image, our demonic double, if you want to call it that, we can anticipate that there will be a controlled opposition already being set up. And what is that? Can we see the evidence of it today?
Is really, really exciting. I think I get what you're trying to imply here. I mean, it's like right out of the playbook here, because if we look at these developments in our modern political arena, we have two parties, two factions on each end of the scale that I personally would say, here's a perfect example of a controlled opposition, the Tea Party movement and the occupation movement.
That's right. That's right. You could say that whereas in the Russian Revolution, we see an example of one specific focus of the controlled opposition in the Bolshevik movement, very clear, enormous amount of historical evidence showing how the international bankers funded the Bolsheviks and sent them in, and they took over and hijacked the ideology of the movement within 6 months of its starting. But in America, we would see more of a splash effect of the opposition movement showing up in a number of different places, one of them being the hijacking of the original intentions of the Tea Party. The other thing is you got to be really careful about looking at the Occupy Wall Street movement and who's behind it and who's running it. We learned a lesson about Zeitgeist, I think. Some of us did anyway. Zeitgeist is just the whole Zeitgeist program platform is just a way of getting people into a kind of blind attitude toward socialism, you see? So that's also an instrument of the controlled opposition. So
well,
we could
I
say
think
that
a page out of the playbook, John, as far as mm-hmm. I've seen in a postmodern America, is the oversimplified explanation. It's the easiest way to trivialize any point you want to make, the oversimplified explanation.
Yeah, like when they say money is debt. That's absolutely wrong. That's a statement. That's a propagandistic psyop statement that was made famous in Zeitgeist. Even though Zeitgeist did tell us some true things and did inform and educate us regarding fractional reserve banking and the corruption of the Fed and the banking system, which is tremendously important information that everyone needs to know. It also injected into all that good information the 5% of the information that was propagandistic and spun. Money is not debt. Money is just an agreed form of exchange between human beings. Fiat money is debt. But they didn't make that distinction in Zeitgeist, and they ought to have because they took such great care to explain what fiat money was. So isn't that a little suspicious?
Well, I think I see what's going on here. It's because what they do is by flavoring the disinfo with a little bit of truth, it discharges the energy that's generated from the rage and the outrage of the individual. It discharges the energy. So even if you've lied to them, right, it's an effective tool at disarming the outrage. So
that's right.
You know, they get a point and they can hold on to that point and let go of the outrage.
Right. So that's one way that we have to look at the many different ways in which the head of the controlled opposition may appear, rather in an octopus fashion. But to get back to the Russian Revolution for a moment, I'd like to give a few details of it that I would suggest that people can apply to the world today. You know, we often hear of the Homeland Security and Janet Napolitano as being compared to the Nazis and the Gestapo. Many thousands of times have we heard this, right? But, they even might be better compared to the Bolsheviks, which is the name that was normally called the Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviks, this is what the Bolsheviks did. The Bolsheviks pioneered the surveillance society. They pioneered the rule, if you see something, say something. That comes from the Bolsheviks. And it doesn't come from them literally that they said that, but that was what they said to the people. They said, in order to co-opt the revolutionary movement, they went to the Russian people who were hungry for revolution, and they said, you have to be careful because there are counter-revolutionaries everywhere. And like Homeland Security is saying, you have to be careful because there are terrorists everywhere, you know? And so they made every citizen spy on every other citizen. And they were so successful in doing this that by the time it reached the Stalin era, which is about 1922, 1923, when he came into power, about 7 years after the revolution kicked off, by the time it reached that era, people were spying on themselves. I have to tell you, the stories that you can read, intimate stories about the Russian Revolution, people were so terrorized by the KGB and by the Bolshevik surveillance that some people went and turned themselves in for things that they didn't even do.
Wow, it's like hysteria.
That's how far the madness goes. Today we're approaching that madness in America. Today you can get jailed, tasered, thrown in a black hole, tortured and murdered for something that you never even did. We know this. It's reached that point of absurdity. But imagine that you would turn yourself in to be tortured and murdered for something that you never did. This shows how far this insanity can go. And there's a tremendous sobering lesson in that, I think.
Absolutely. It's thought crime. You know, it's straight out of
thought crime.
Orwell. Yeah.
That's right. Thought crime really makes people go insane. Now, the one other point that I want to make about this parallel that I'm drawing in this chronology before we go into the Sophianic aspect or the spiritual aspect of the Russian Revolution is simply this. After October 1917, when the Bolsheviks, which simply means the majority in the Duma, took over and co-opted and hijacked the revolution, there was a civil war in Russia. Now, if this parallelism or this mirroring that I'm suggesting is true, then what I'm saying is that there will be simultaneously a revolution in Russia, a revolution in America against federal tyranny, the war of terror upon the populace, and at the same time, a civil war within that revolution. Try to get your mind into that scenario.
It's chaos.
A war of revolt against the feds and a civil war, that is, people fighting each other in a civil war. Now, if there were a civil war to happen in the United States, What form would it take? Well, let's go back and look at the mirror of the Russian Revolution. There was a civil war, and the two factions in that war were called the Red and the White. The Red Russians and the White Russians. And the Red Russians were those who were involved with the power structure of the Bolsheviks. And the White Russians were those who wanted to defend the original concept of the revolution as a people's revolution. And so it split into that faction. So, do you have any idea how we might see that similar kind of split unfolding in America today? Does that suggest anything to you?
Well, you're talking about political persuasion, political parties?
I'm talking not about so much about parties, but about movements in the United States, movements that are in dissent against the government, but that are also have a deep ideological split in those movements.
Well, the ones that I just brought up before, the Tea Party movement and the occupation.
That's
movement.
True. That's true. And I might suggest two others. I might suggest the Christian militias.
Okay.
The Christian militias in the United States, who are make no bones about it, do they? They are
like
ready with guns
like
loaded.
Like the Minutemen. Like the Minutemen.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the Christian militias are have the intention.
Okay, we'll be right back, John. We'll continue after this break. We wanted to just kind of wrap up this point, John, and give you a chance to incorporate the Sophianic vision into everything we're talking about, because we don't want it to be all about the doom and gloom and the dark prognosis. We want to offer a solution here, too, and we want to talk about the hope of what we see in all this. So, John, if you want to pick it back up where we left off, you were talking about the Christian fundamentalist movement in America.
Yeah, the Christian militia movements.
Okay.
Would correspond. They will certainly play a great role if there is a revolution in America, a civic uprising. And they're ready. They're armed to the teeth, and they're ready to play that role. There's no secret about that, is there? They say it every chance they get.
Yeah.
They might be compared to the White Russians in the breakdown that occurred in the revolution, in the Civil War, the faction of the White Russians. And, of course, the trouble with the Christian militias is that they're Christian. And, you know, they have the ideology of the Bible and the ideology of the righteous retribution from the Father and so forth. And they have that religious insanity driving. They may be patriots. I'm sure some of them are genuine patriots who would love to see the Republic restored and love to see the Constitution observed. But they, as to the extent that they're contaminated by the religious ideology of the Old and New Testaments, that's just going to lead to more disaster for the American people. So I don't want to go further into the dark side. Let's move away from that. I just want to suggest that if you go back and look at these points in the Russian Revolution, they give brilliant reflections to what's happening now. What I'd like to concentrate on and what's imminently happening this year, what I'd like to concentrate on now is the what was the Sophianic aspect behind the Russian Revolution? What was present in the mentality of the Russian people at the time of the revolution, 1905, with the first civic uprisings, and then through on into the depths of the revolution, that corresponds to something that we might rediscover today? Well, it's amazing if you read this brief article, Occult Roots of the Russian Revolution, as how many points it brings up here that point to a kind of what I would call a kind of groundswell of social mysticism in the Russian people. And as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation here, Frederick, the focus of this groundswell was the earth itself, Mother Russia, the land of Russia. They saw in the land of Russia, in the body of that massive continental territory, the presence of some kind of looming spirit coming out. And attached to the recognition of that looming spirit coming out of the earth, they had fantastic utopian schemes that were presented. You know, there was a lot of talk about free energy. There was a lot of talk about developing communes where people could live freely and grow their own food and be self-sufficient. There was enormous amount of writing and literature and circulation of pamphlets and magazines dedicated to this idea of Mother Russia as the earth who would awaken the conscience of the people. And the people in turn would then, in their collective uprising, express the conscience of God or of the divine spirit. This is a fantastic idea that was an obsession not only among the intellectual classes such as Soloviev and Bailey and Bloch and other poets and intellectuals, but also vastly spread through the masses, vastly spread through the serfs who believed in this idea as well.
I think what is really fascinating and exciting about this point, John, is the fact that these people didn't just deduce this. They didn't just conclude these ideas. These ideas grew in their identity as a people who were a part of the land.
That's actually true. They would probably have said themselves that these ideas came from the land. Soloviev said that. Soloviev was a Russian mystic, Vladimir Soloviev, S-O-L-O-V-I-E-F. Kind of the godfather of the mystical social movement behind the Russian Revolution. And he actually himself claims to have had three visions or direct encounters with the divine Sophia. Did you know that?
I did not. That's yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, if you read his biography, you'll find that he famously recounted his mystical visions in which he actually encountered a being he called the divine Sophia. And so being a mystic and being one of the antennas of the race, of the Russian people, the artist is the spiritual antenna of the race, right?
Sure.
And the mystic is an even the spiritual lightning rod of the race, you could say, you know, the mystic. He had this experience and wrote about it and was tremendously inspiring to many people. By the way, if you want to, anyone wants to do a deep study of this and read some really amazing historical facts, the key book to get here is The Occult in Russian and Soviet Culture. It's a collection of essays edited by a woman named Bernice Rosenthal, R-O-S-E-N-T-H-A-L. That book alone will open your mind to the scope and the power of this Sophianic vision that was emerging in the collective imagination of the Russian people. And a great many of the early revolutionaries, including Dostoevsky himself, Chernyshevsky, and even later ones, kind of like Lunacharsky, who was kind of a party member in the Russian, in the Bolshevik regime, carried out and held the flame of this vision in the most remarkable way, until it was ultimately crushed out by the Bolsheviks and by Stalin. So what is the lesson here?
Could you repeat the name of that, the name and author of that book, The Occult in Russian and German?
Yeah, The Occult in Russian and Soviet Culture.
Russian and German or Russian and Soviet?
In Russian and Soviet
culture. And an author?
Rosenthal. Did I say German at first?
I thought maybe you did, but I could have just heard it wrong.
Bernice Rosenthal. It's a tremendous book of a collection of essays that go into all aspects of this in the most remarkable detail and depth. So I want to point out here again another parallel, because we're using the Russian Revolution and the conditions of the revolution to describe, as a mirror reflection of what is happening on the planet today, but particularly in the United States of America. Well, you know, it says here in the article that the intellectuals in the Russian capital of St. Petersburg had an idea of founding what they called a religion of humanity. And this idea was like is described here as a Gnostically inspired sect of God-manhood, this idea of the God-manship, or realizing the God in ourselves, is very much elaborated by Soloviev. And so there was a call for a kind of sweeping realization of the divine in people. And is there some echo of that today in what we hear about 2012 and the planetary shift?
Yeah, and free energy you mentioned before, too. I mean,
that's
it's
right.
Just amazing.
Not only the freeing of the sovereign power of the individual, whether you want to call it divine or not, that's a matter of syntax, perhaps. The freeing of the sovereign power of the individual and the freeing of society to be a theater of mutual aid with a new technology, with an Earth-based technology and free energy systems, was all throbbing wildly and vividly in the minds of the Russian people at the time of the Russian Revolution. I mean, isn't that amazing?
It is totally amazing. I'm astounded by it.
Yeah, I mean, it was really fantastic, and many, many intellectuals, many Russian radicals already starting in the middle of the 19th century, purported and elaborated this idea, and they were incredibly eloquent about it. There was just one problem, one big problem that they had. Well, they had the problem of the Bolsheviks, who were going to suppress all that, just as today the New World Order psychopaths and the terrorists who are waging the war on terror want to suppress anything like that in humanity. They want to suppress our sovereignty. They want to suppress individual conscience. They want to suppress the intelligence and the freedom of the individual. That is exactly what the Bolsheviks wanted to do in regard to the Russian Revolution. They wanted to make money off it. They wanted it because they were funded and directed by the globalist bankers, and they wanted the revolution to be totally hijacked and perverted to their needs. So this very same struggle between a wave of spiritual enlightenment or awakening, if you will, and the totalitarian terrorism is happening today. We're reliving the elements of the Russian Revolution, but with one huge difference, one huge positive difference. When it comes to the Sofianic vision that so inspired them, we have something that they didn't have. We have the complete mystery school narrative for the practice of that vision.
That's awesome. We have the restored solution.
That's right. We have the story of Sophia. And there's one thing that I would point out in my role and responsibility as a comparative mythologist, and this is one of the most important things I could ever say to anyone who follows my talks and my writings. I've been compared to Joseph Campbell, a great comparative mythologist. I take up that mission and I carry it forward. And speaking as a comparative mythologist, I can tell you that there is no social revolutionary movement on this planet that can ever succeed if it does not have a narrative focus. Because the human imagination is what wells up. The human imagination now wants to break free. We're at the verge of saying, enough of this. We don't want to be bullied. We don't want to be pushed around. We don't want to be enslaved by the deceitful and murderous lies of a small group of psychopaths. We want to be free, and we want to be able to live out of our love for life and out of the power of our imagination, just to get up every day and imagine what a fantastic world we can have in the spirit of mutual aid and in the spirit of cooperation and equanimity. Just imagine that, and we want to be free to let our imaginations blossom. But I'm warning you that the imagination, the collective and social imagination, cannot succeed in any venture, no matter how idealistic, unless it has a guiding narrative. You know why the Nazis were so successful? You know, you got to hand them something, my friends. The Nazis were incredibly successful. When you look at what they did in a mere few decades, you've got to be impressed. Why were they able to achieve what they did in such a short period of time? It's because they had a guiding narrative. They had the heroic Aryan race supremacy myth. That's a guiding narrative. And with a myth, which is not a lie, but a real narrative born out of imagination that can be tested and proven, with a myth behind it, the social revolution can have its spiritual component. And that spiritual component can help to define the ideology of the revolution and keep it on track. And that is what would have happened if the Sofianic vision that was blossoming and burgeoning and erupting in the souls of the Russian people, as you say very well, Friedrichs, it wasn't given to them or forced on them. It arose spontaneously out of their soul life. if they had been allowed to pursue that, and if they had what we have today, the Thelestic message and the Sophianic vision story, that whole event could have unfolded in a very, very different fashion. But they did not have that foundation. It was a tragic omission.
But we do.
We do. That's right. I want to say, I'm not preaching to anybody. Do I preach? I'm not a preacher. Okay.
You're not.
I'm not recruiting anybody to the Sophianic vision story. I'm not trying to be a guru and form a cult. I'm just saying, if you don't know what it is, go take a look at it. That's all. Just go on MetaHistory.org and sample it. The Sophia Mythos. You'll see that there's... Or read my book. Just see what it is and see how it strikes you. You know, I'm not selling anybody on this, but I'm telling you from my expertise as a comparative mythologist that there is no way a massive social uprising can succeed if it doesn't have a guiding narrative that the participants can agree on.
Okay, John, it looks like we have a call. You want to take a moment and see what they have to
sure.
say? Okay.
Sure. I'm up for it.
You're on, Peter Gowan, live on Radio for Humanity.
Hey, Frater, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Sorry I didn't call in sooner. I was enjoying listening to John talk. I did want to make a couple points about what you guys were talking about earlier. I had a question.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. I wanted to point out that you were talking about the Albigensian Crusades and the destruction of the Cathars. And you said talking about how they were, the mystery schools were protected and the Gnostics were protected at some point. I wanted to point out that the Knights Templar they voluntarily opted out of that crusade and they didn't take part in that. I believe that was not just because the crusades took place on the European soil or the Christian soil, but also because they had, that was a part of their belief system. They had come across that in Jerusalem. And I had a question about the mystery schools you were talking about with the Gnosticism, the early Christian mystics. And I was curious, do we know what the nature of the ritual was? What it might have consisted of?
What ritual?
In the mystery schools, did they have a ritual?
Yes, they did. The ritual was called mathesis, which means learning or education. So it's often thought, and mistakenly and erroneously, because there is absolutely no evidence to say this, but it's often claimed by David Icke and other people that the mystery schools were bad, and that they were the incubation tanks for the Illuminati, and that they were the first places or ancient places where brainwashing and initiatory practices, initiatory rites were performed of a satanic nature. That is completely wrong. There is absolutely no single drop of evidence of that. In fact, we know very little about what they actually did in the mystery schools because those activities were protected by a vow of silence. Not a vow of secrecy, simply a vow of silence. And the reason for that vow of silence was so that when people came into the mysteries to have the ultimate ritual, they would be able to go to that ritual in a state of purity without preconceptions that would mislead them or cloud their attention. And that ritual was to be taken. It was called mathesis. It was also called apotheosis. It had various names. To be taken into the presence of the organic light. That was the soul and supreme ritual of the telestai of the mysteries. To be taken into the presence of the organic light, which is also the grail. And that's the only ritual they had. When you talk about these other rituals which are erroneously attached to the mystery schools, like the empowerment of the king, the empowerment of the Babylonian god kings, the empowerment rites of the theocrats and everything, all that was a theater that was orchestrated and manipulated by certain individuals. And that was not the method or practice of the mystery school. That was the method and practice of the handlers of the theocratic rulers. And this is a very important distinction to make.
Okay, listen, John, I hope that helped answer Peter's question, but I want to get that last caller in unless you want to.
Okay, let's
some.
Do.
Yeah, we have one more caller. Peter, okay, I'm sorry, I want to go on to the next caller, but that was a great question. I hope that gave you some clarity. Okay, caller at the 267 area code. You are live with John Lash. Go ahead.
Hi, John. It's great to hear you tonight, and I thank you for your friendship with Freaker X. Wonderful work.
Okay,
hello?
This is Jay, right? Correct?
Yeah.
Hey, good evening, Jay. Good evening. Good morning.
Good morning, John. I just want to thank you for the excellent work you're doing. The website is Telestai.org, not
.com.
Yeah,
that's right. Telestai.org.com.
Yeah.
Thank you for correcting me on that. That's correct.
If people want to know what's going on in the nuts and bolts society, all they have to do is go to Amazon.com. and purchase two books by Anthony C. Sutton.
Right.
Mr. Sutton breaks down the rise of Hitler and the bankers. He breaks down the Bolshevik Revolution and the bankers. And he breaks down Skull and Bones. And Anthony C. Sutton is a good mainstream researcher, excellent stuff. It's simple. Spend $100, buy four of his books, and you'll understand. The only other book I can say, besides your own, of course, but I think your work is deeper than just the political financial system. You need to understand you live in a corrupt world and break the programming first, and then move on into what you're doing. And I know we're short on time, and I just want to say we'd like Fraser and I would like to send you some of our organite for you to look at.
Well, that's wonderful. Okay? I'd be a happy recipient of your organite.
Okay,
thank you very
great,
much.
Great.
Okay.
And when are you going to do another Time Monk Radio?
That I don't know. I haven't been invited yet to do that, but we are looking forward to another one. Thank you. If I may respond to what you said very quickly, Sutton's work, I think, on the Skull and Bones and on the background of the corruption and the rigged system in our world is excellent, and I believe it's trustworthy. He was inspired and directed by Charlotte Isabet, who is an amazingly remarkable woman whose father was a member of Skull and Bones, and she kind of broke the whole thing open, this woman, Charlotte Isabet. Anyway, it's really important to understand this, but I again would like to make a point that some of the people who have investigated this type of thing, the Skull and Bones, the Illuminati, the secret societies that are corrupting our world institutions and their links to the financial mafia, some of those people make a mistake when they go back before 1700. We don't have to go back before 1700. We can go back to about 1775, say, when the Illuminati were founded, and come ahead from there and make a deep study of those things through Sutton and other reliable sources, and we can understand exactly what we're facing today. The mistake that some of the researchers make who do that, such as David Icke, is that they jump back into mythology and ancient history and back into the mysteries, and that's material that they're really not qualified to handle. So although they can do a very good job in informing us, as Sutton does, about these orchestrations of these social psychopaths and the banking mafia, they do an excellent job of informing us of that. But when they go back and talk about what happened in the mysteries, and when they attribute the satanic activities of certain people today to ancient rites of pagans and rites in the mystery schools, they're really doing a disservice to the people that they would purport to help. And I really need to point this out, because I am qualified to go back and evaluate that ancient material, the mythology and the ancient lore of the mystery schools, and they're not. And it's very unfortunate that they would present their interpretations to the world, which are very misleading. And they are not to be trusted in any respect in that manner. And I'm not going to name any other names, but you just know who I'm talking about.
John, I'm just going to let Jay know right now, because I had to. We got to wrap this up. Jay, we will get the address so we can ship some organite to John, and I'll forward that to you. I already have Jay's contact information. But, John, there's just a couple minutes left. I wanted to give you the last thought of the evening after thanking everyone for being here tonight and all the people listening in the archives. Go ahead, John Lash.
Well, I think we're looking at a fantastic opportunity and a challenge, and despite all the darkness and the insane murderous deceit that's being, the assault upon humanity, the tremendous opportunity to see if there could be a planet-wide revolution, a planet-wide civic uprising against tyranny, against the psychopaths, and I emphasize the word, and if that planet-wide uprising of a social and collective nature could be inspired and informed by a genuine spiritual vision, so that it would be a social hyphen spiritual uprising. And I would ask people who are listening to this interview to think about what kind of narrative and what kind of true and veracious myth could guide such a revolution.
Awesome sentiment, John. I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening. We look forward to your return in the near future. We've already discussed some other points we want to bring up, which everyone will be happy to hear about as time goes by. Everyone, stay tuned next week. Check out John's website, metahistory.org. Stay tuned next week. We have David Cereda here at Radio Free Humanity with Frater X. Thank you again, everyone, and have a good evening. What's left of it?